Welcome to another episode of the Stellar Sound Podcast, the only podcast dedicated to astronauts, all the while rocking it on all the interdimensions, space traveling radars to empower creative musicians everywhere. I'm your host, Leanne Paulson, and today I'm joined by Sarah Tip. But first, become part of our interstellar presence, find us at thestellarsoundpodcast.com, on all social platforms at Stellar Sound Podcast, or join our astronauts in the Stellar Sound Community Discord server. Links are in the description. Serentip is a Bangkok-born Swedish-Thai experimental trilingual vocalist and multimodal artist. From her early beginnings performing in jazz lounges in Stockholm to her musical adventures in the North Pacific, Serentip has become one of the formative female voices in the contemporary music scene, blazing the trail for all artists driven by the passions for intertwined, intermotive, and conscientious compositions. A lot of C's in that sentence. Wow. Serentip, welcome to the Stellarmageddon, and how are you today?
Thank you so much, Leandri. I'm doing well.
I am really happy to hear it. We were like pre-recording. We were just discussing early morning recordings. And it's luckily not too early morning where you're at right now. But we both have had it where it's just been too early. So we're in the golden zone of time zones right now on both sides. I'm really happy. But we're really happy to have you here today, and I can't wait just to dive into everything because I find your musical journey so interesting and so just creative. And I know that's the most basic and simplest word to use, but yeah.
Thank you so much.
And like, let's just start out with the humblest of jazz beginnings. I like that you on your website mentioned Diana Krall as an inspiration. And how you said jazz was initially like a moment for freedom and finding your identity and experiencing it. And when I think of jazz, and I'm as a musician, I hate saying this out loud because I know people get so mad, but jazz to me is such a genre or such a musical style that's loosely based in a fixed structure. And what I mean with that is, of course, it has a foundation, it has a structure like all musical styles do, but you can do whatever you want with it.
Yeah.
And the best way I like, not the best way, there's this meme where a cat falls on the piano, and then this is like this overlay that says jazz, and that's the meme. And I want to know, what about this strange style was so liberating and that allowed you to express your freedom and your own identity? And why did this genre grab you?
I think it might have come from, I started actually playing classical music, both violin and piano. So I grew up in Bangkok in Thailand, and it's very common that Asian kids start on the piano and on the violin. So that's where I started too. And I also played Thai traditional instruments. But I think that when I was finally exposed to jazz in my teens, it was so liberating after having years of being told to play exactly what's on the page and what the composer wanted me to do, to finally be like, you know what? It's not about what's on the page. It's about what you bring to the table. And to me, that was really, really liberating after needing to play exactly what is there.
Every the fixed structure. That's probably, I love that you put it that way because same. I've also been classically trained, and it was so not, I didn't explore jazz at all. Unfortunately, I wish I did, but it's true. When you are studying classical music, even just as a child, the beginning phase is like, you have to play every note, every phrase, every tempo to the precise thing. That is so boxing. And I think that's where a lot of kids actually lose their love for music because it's very rigid and strict.
And I think for me too, I was, especially as a kid, I was dealing with so much performance anxiety. And being classically trained, we would have these like piano competitions, and I had a Russian piano teacher, and she very much made sure that like I could not play anything wrong. And I think coming from that too, of then going to jazz, of like, you know, if I mess up but I can make it musically, then that's my version of it. And that was just so liberating.
That's a very nice way to put it. I was wondering, I like to ask people this that start in a certain genre, like if you're a metal artist or hip-hop artist or jazz artist, what was the, if you can think back, what was the first jazz song that made you go, oh, I really like this? Can you remember?
Jazz song, that's a tough one.
that's a tough one, right? Like,
I can't remember a song. I can just remember the artists. So for me, I was so drawn to Diana Krall because at that time I was playing piano and I was also singing, to then see an artist do both at the same time and then adding her own, you know, spice to it, making it her own way, for me that was mind-blowing. But then from Diana Krall I started to dig deeper and I discovered Ella Fitzgerald and, you know, Louis Armstrong and Carmen McRae and Betty Carter and Bobby McFerrin, and yeah, it was totally like mind-blowing. But I also remember that I really loved Diane Reeves, and I had discovered her pretty early on too. And what I really loved about her, and I think has really informed my way of performing jazz and arranging, was the arrangements of that she did of standards. So she would not just play a standard like normally you read the head and the chords and you know, have typical beginnings and endings. She would actually have really fleshed out arrangements, and I really love that. And the same thing with Esperanza Spalding too.
Oh wow, that makes sense. I want to just ask you a bit about competitions, because one big one that you partook in was the Thelonious Monk International Jazz Competition. And to an outsider, when I think that, it's like someone telling me they did the NFL halftime show, basically. It's on that level, right? And I think, why? Yes, this is insane. First of all, congratulations. Second of all, because that competition is so big in the world, especially in the jazz, the jazz world, in the music world. It's really big, and it has like launched careers like Chris Porter or like Gretchen Parlato, if I can like just throw out some names over there. And to think that you get the call, you're a finalist, you can partake in this. What is the mental, the physical, the musical prep that goes into getting yourself ready for this competition?
You know, Leandri, I wish that I could give you a better answer, but the entire experience happened so fast.
Yeah.
So I just moved to New York in August of 2015, at the end of it. And like 2 days after I moved to New York, I started school, Manhattan School of Music, for my master's degree.
Yeah.
And during the orientation week, I was just talking to other students and they're like, yeah, this Thelonious Monk competition is happening. The deadline is next week. You should totally apply. And I'm like,
okay.
And you need like an up-tempo song, a ballad, just you need 5 different songs. I don't remember exactly the requirements. Yeah. So I just literally asked students who had just met a few days earlier. We went into a rehearsal room and we just recorded these songs, and then I submitted them. And then I needed to go back to Sweden to move out of my apartment. And as I'm trying to like get everything out of my apartment, at 3 a.m. in the morning, I get this call. Hey, you made it to the competition. I'm like, you know, and I was there with my best friends, and we were just screaming and crying, and it was insane, because I everyone told me like, you can't expect to get it. It's so hard to get.
Yes.
Yeah. So I was not really expecting it. But it happened, and I was so happy about it. But at the same time, I really need to get my stuff out of the apartment because I'm going to fly back to New York.
I was gonna ask you, is there like one word you could use to describe the experience? I feel improv is going to be so funny.
Yes, it was definitely improvisation. And I think the biggest takeaway is always like, you should always be ready, because you never know when you need to do something.
Be on that stage at the competition. I mean, it can happen.
Exactly. I after the call, I had 1 month to prepare. And again, I just moved to New York. So then I was trying to move into my apartment here and open up an American bank account, get an American phone number. Like, they're just understanding American culture. There was so many other life things going on. And then at the same time, trying to prepare for this competition and going to school. But the good thing was I studied with Gretchen Parlato. She was my vocal teacher.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So she was able to guide me, and she was like, just stay true to you and do what you feel like is showcasing you the best.
Okay.
So I brought my own spin to the table, and I brought some crazy arrangements, which in hindsight might not have been the best idea because I had a 10-minute rehearsal with the band who performed with us at the competition. So that's like a 10-minute rehearsal for three songs is 3 minutes a song. It's not a lot of time.
I'm going to be honest with you. This is not the answer that I expected from that question. I was like, yeah, I had like months and then I did this and then I, you know, took yoga and or like meditation and no,
it was not just the boom, case. Boom. Yeah.
That's crazy.
I did not win. But I'm happy about that too, because
experience, yeah.
I had that experience. I got to perform for Didi Bridgewater, Al Jarreau, and like Quincy Jones was there, Herbie was there. It was insane. But the point of it all is that when you apply for the competition, you need to sign a record deal with Concord. So in case you win, you need to put out an album with them. And because I didn't win, I had like open options. So after the competition, I met up with Michael Leigh, who's the band leader of Snarky Puppy, and then he offered me a contract with Ground Up Music.
And I mean, that's just been the stage for you, if you
it's
will.
It's been my family.
Yeah. So in the end, we did not win, but we did win.
Yes, no, exactly.
That definitely counts. When I think about your music, though, and once again, also your teaching, your albums, your entire style, artistry style, the first thing that comes to mind is it always has some type of cause. And I say that with a lot of respect. Most of your collaborations, projects do have some, it's not just a song, to put it that, or it's not just a musical piece. There's a reason for it. It's a very conscientious way of writing. But one thing that stands out of everything that stands out to me was, and I'm going to butcher this name and I apologize, but the Skrubfestivalen from Sweden.
Oh, Skrubfestivalen, yeah.
There we go. Okay, great. You said it much better. You said it properly. I want to quickly just touch on that. From the description online, it says it's a free festival for equality and anti-racism and the Anti-Racism Society in Skrub, Sweden. What was the catalyst for this? Because I know you were one of the creators or collaborators with this. What was the catalyst for the creation of this festival?
So in Sweden, it's a different type of education system than in the US. And I think maybe in some European countries, they might have this too. But I think it's mostly in Scandinavia. It's called a folk high school. And in the US, you would kind of compare it to a pre-college. But it's different because it's not happening while you're in high school. It's literally a school you go to after high school, before college. And it's usually in the middle of nowhere. And you just go there for 2 years. And for my school and my jazz program that I went there, we had 7 hours of ensembles a week. And then you would just live in this place with all your classmates. There were like 20 of us in the middle of nowhere. And there's a music studio and rehearsal studios that's open 24/7. So all you do every day for 2 years without distraction is to practice and to write music and to play with your friends and to learn and grow.
It's like boot camp, but extreme.
Yeah. And it was so amazing, but because it was placed in this very small town outside of Malmö, which is in the south of Sweden, it was a very small town, and unfortunately there was a lot of prejudice against people who are not native Swedes. So one day when me and my friend who is from Ethiopia, we were going to the grocery store, there were guys just driving by and stopping in the car and yelling at us. Another day when me and my friend, we were trying to go to the grocery store again. You know, there's nothing else to do in this town but to go to the grocery store.
Do groceries.
Then there were other people driving by in the car and they would throw eggs at us.
Oh, wow.
And for me, you know, I understand that for them, like, they see all these people who are not from there coming to the school and living in their community and saw us as a threat. So yeah. I decided to create that festival to just invite the town in so they can see we're super friendly. We just want to be friends with you and make some music and art, and you're welcome to enjoy it. So I created the festival and made it free just because of that. And I also had, like, the elementary school in the town perform, do a band thing, do a dance thing. I had some other local musicians perform, and then I brought some bigger headliner artists. There was one group that I can't remember their names now. Do you know the name of the band when they sang "I Don't Care, I Love It"?
Yes. Yes.
Why can't I remember their names?
Oh, I'm going to just climb on the internet immediately because that's going to bother me so much. But they were there.
No.
Oh.
I got an opportunity to book them, but they were too expensive, or I decided to not focus on them. I went with another artist, which his name was Tingsek, and he's also incredible.
Icona Pop.
Anyways, I got an opportunity to book them and I did not. And that's also one of the biggest mistakes of my life, that I didn't book them, because it was right before they, like, blew up with that song.
Yeah. It was so close, but okay. That's the thing we can look back on. A learning period.
Also, it was a very small budget festival, you know, because it was all raised by ourselves and it was free to the public.
It's a really small town from what I could gather.
Yeah, I think there's like 20,000 people there.
Yeah. I hate to ask this, and I'm really hoping for a positive answer, but is it still ongoing, the festival, or has it died out?
Yes. I think in the past year it happened. So every year now, the students of the school, they put it on and do it. Yeah. But there's been some years that the students don't do it, but most of the years since then, they have been doing it.
I imagine during COVID, obviously, as the rest of the world. but Sarah, okay. I would like to move on to a segment called Behold the Meteor Shower. This segment is a set of rapid fire questions that you will have to answer with the first word that comes to mind. So it's non-canceling, relatively easy questions, but, you know, sometimes we get interesting answers. So I'm going to just ask you, are you ready to behold the meteor shower?
Okay. I apologize for any misspoken things ahead of time.
Okay, here we go. If you could be any instrument, which one would you be? First one, right
Am
at
I
the
on
gate.
The clock?
I would just set up a timer real quick. No.
I would probably be the voice.
The voice, that is an instrument. So that, yes, that it works. SpongeBob or Patrick?
I don't really watch SpongeBob.
You're the fourth person in a row that said that. Like, the first, I think season two's first half was like, they nailed it with, like, I want to be this one. And then the second half, and you're in the first episode for season three, but, like, they, like, I don't really watch it. Which is interesting. It's a dying cartoon, I think.
No, it's not. I have been meaning to watch it. I just haven't watched it yet, but my husband loves it.
He loves it. Okay, you can post interview, I think, ask him to describe you as a Patrick or a SpongeBob. Okay. And I don't know if that's going to be great for your marriage, but, you know. Okay, do pineapples belong on pizza?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. Yes. Which movie has the best soundtrack?
I would say The Joker.
The Joker?
Yeah.
That's it. Interesting choice. I can get behind that.
I believe I'm gonna butcher her name, but I'm pretty sure her name is Hildur Gunnarsdóttir. She is Icelandic and she wrote the score for it.
There's a very big upcomings of female composers in film these days, which I'm loving. I mean, they've been there, but they're getting the big ones.
They haven't really been there, though. There's not that many. And there's still, like, the majority is men. I think only 2% of film composers are women.
I'm just happy. And whenever I see a female's name there, I'm like, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Where is my... Okay, there we go. Which Friends character are you?
Can I pass on this one? I haven't watched in so long and I can't remember their names.
It's fine. So, like, I asked a friend this the other day just for the fun of it. She's like, I don't remember the names. The blonde one. I'm like, most of them were blonde at one stage. Right. Best musical advice ever given to you?
Music first.
That's music what first.
Yeah. Like, you Ooh. Should always focus on the music first. It's so easy to get caught up in, like, music business or administrative Politics. Work and all the other things. But yeah, just music first. Music first.
Smoothly awesome. Transition into a next talking point that I would like to discuss with you, and it's your composition techniques. So I'm going to be very honest here. I feel that I follow music composition, I'm going to say this with a grain of salt, trends relatively well. If there's a way of composing, I feel like I know about it. But then you and one of our Stellar Sound members, Zorana, has introduced me to a new one, which is data sonification. So, and I was just like, data what? And then I had to go look it up and like just do a little bit of research on it. And it's a really interesting way of composing. And you use a lot of composition techniques and processes. Like you use the pedal effects with your voice, and you like to mix elements of different genres, like especially with the jazz and the pop and everything. But this is a very futuristic one. And I love that on your Instagram, you do have a video where you kind of simplify it and kind of break it down for us. But for everyone watching slash listening, what is data sonification?
Well,
no, but give us a free masterclass while you're here.
Well, you take some. Well, so I think the simple answer to break it down is that you can take any kind of data set and then you translate it into pitches. And if you're very mathematical, then you can do that math of if you have, let's say, you have 7 values.
Yeah.
And you have 7 pitches. So then one value gets one pitch, the other value gets another pitch. But with the data that I've been doing recently, I was on a research vessel with 25 scientists in the North Pacific.
Yeah.
And on this research vessel, they have a real-time camera machine called ISIS, and it's spelled ISIS.
Yeah.
And that video captures all the planktons in the water in real time. And then it also can process everything it sees and turns it into data. And there's so much data.
Yeah.
I might not remember the numbers completely because, as you know, now I'm bad with names and I'm bad with numbers. But they were telling me that every day they have 8 terabytes of data.
Wow.
There's so much data. That's a lot. Yeah. And I asked them on the ship if they can give me some of the data so I can do data sonification with it. And to get the data for 1.5 seconds, it was like over 3,000 rows of values in Microsoft Excel. So that's a lot of data. So then when you're doing data sonification with that, you might want to expand your notes. So for that, I work with multiple octaves.
Okay. Yeah.
In order, just so I don't have only like that, I'm going through 3,000 values of data and I can only put it on 7 notes. That if I have more octaves, then I actually have a wider range. And with data sonification, it's just a tool to be able to comprehend the data. And like I said, with all this data that I was processing, when you look in Excel and you just see all these numbers, it's so hard to digest. But when you turn it into music, you can actually hear when the values go up or when the values go down. And it's much easier to comprehend. And if you think about any song, I don't even know how many notes I have in a song. But somehow the brain has an easier time organizing it when it's a pitch than when it's just numbers.
Yeah, right. I think one of the Instagram posts about your time at Artists at Sea, you did showcase this a little bit in your door project. I was like, I'd never thought of it this way, and I never realized that the brain does this. In but the Instagram video where you were like breaking down data certification, you said that what you like about it is that it allows you to write songs with a deeper meaning, and it also mm-hmm. reduces the stress of starting from scratch. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, it's great for any songwriter everywhere. But I want to know, how did you discover data certification, or who enlightened you on this world for the first time? And then when you wrote your first composition using data certification, did it go the way that you would hope, or did it sound just completely shit?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, Leonri. So actually for me, that video that you're talking about, that was when I broke down the rising global temperatures. That was from mm-hmm. NASA's website from 1980 up until 2012. And how I got into it was because I wanted to write a song based on this concept of rising temperatures. And my whole concept of my album Carbon that just dropped today.
Yeah.
Yay. Was that I wanted to make sure that I'm not putting everything in the lyric. I didn't want the lyric to be the storyteller. I wanted the music mm-hmm. to be the storyteller. Mm-hmm. So I was like, what if I just go to NASA's website and do some research? And then I found this set of data. I'm like, what if I could put it into pitches? And I was Googling, and then I found this computer like browser app called Two-Tone, where you can input any type of data. So I inputted the data from NASA's website into Two-Tone, and then it would just play it chronologically from 1880 up until 2012. And if you've ever seen the graph of the rising temperatures, you can see that it goes pretty much the same, and then at the very end it's whoop. And that's kind of like how the data sounded too. It was like, and to me, it felt very expected. And mm-hmm. like you said, I don't think that it sounded like shit, but I did feel like it didn't emotionally grab me.
Yeah.
And for me, that's an important part too. I think it's very important that my music can stand alone by itself, and for people to be able to appreciate it, even if they don't understand where it's coming from. So I decided to kind of like choose my own years that are significant to me and significant to our world, and build patterns of that. And that's how I tell the story. So the piece that I wrote is actually jumping around different years, just to make it a little bit more musical and emotional.
Emotive. That's just great segue, because I really want to get into this time in the North Pacific, because it's not just you didn't just randomly jump on a boat and there you were like, hey, can I use your data? It wasn't a thing. it was something you applied for. It was I'm going to get this right. The Sitka Center of Ecology and Art had a program called Artists at Sea, and then you apply, you get nominated, and you were one of two out of something like 120 or something, right?
There were 120 artists who applied, and I was one of two for this year. And then there's going to be two more next year. So in the fall of 2023, we're going to have an exhibit where we're presenting all our work that we did on the ship.
And then the question is, of course, what is this? Why are they taking artists onto ships with scientists? Yeah, what is this?
I don't know if you've ever heard the term STEM in the U.S. It's for the education system. Mm-hmm. And now they're starting to understand the importance of arts and how the arts can help communicate, especially science. So they're turning STEM into STEAM.
Yeah.
So it actually helps for the science programs to get funding from the National Science Foundation if they have an arts component.
Okay. That's amazing. All the videos and all the posts and all the little sound bites, or I say sound bites, like it's just like a word, but music that you guys made there is really, it's so fitting to the footage that is also posted of it. Like I said, when we were talking about the sonification, it's so interesting to see the videos and how it directly translates onto music, and how it just runs parallel. It's like such a symbiotic relationship. It's so strange to actually see that. And the things that came from there are, it's, You wouldn't expect it to be so good on the ear. You would expect it to sound just weird, honestly. But it's so musical. It's weird. Your brain doesn't want to comprehend it. And of course, you're right. While you were on board, you guys were just busy. It was creating compositions, creating sounds for the planktons, taking video footage, creating music soundtracks for it. You guys did, as you said, AR and VR compositions for it. And then I love how you say, and I want to get into this because I cannot comprehend this. You said, this is one of the most creatively inspirational moments in your career / life. Which I get if I look at the footage because it looked amazing. But then you see this data, you see this footage, you work with these inspirational scientists and fellow artists and everything. Great. Very inspirational. Backing you on that. But then you go back to the tiny little cabin studio that you guys created in the hull of the ship and you've worked long hours. How do you maintain that inspiration and that feeling of creativity afterwards? Because if I had to work that long hours in that conditions and go back to that cabin, I would be like,
Well, actually, me and the VR artists and the lead scientist, we were so-called floaters. Yeah. So we did not have a rigid schedule. The other scientists, they were divided into two teams where they needed to work from 3 a.m. to 3 p.m. and 3 p.m. to 3 a.m. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But we could just jump in anywhere at any time. So I didn't work for like 16 hours a day. I probably worked for 14 or 15. Okay, yeah. That's pretty long. But my point is, for me, it's fun because it's a different type of work. I think if I only needed to do one thing for 14 hours, I would be exhausted. But I got to change the scenery all the time. I would go and help these scientists sample whatever is happening and go and count the different jellies and put them in bags and look at the footage and, you know, and then I would go down to the basement and work on my music. And then I would go up again. And then one of the scientists, Alejandro, he would teach me. He would like give me a science lesson.
Oh, that's awesome. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, so it felt so varied, and that's why I had the energy to do what I did.
That makes it sound much better than I pictured everything. I honestly was imagining you guys being just hauled in this tiny little cabin and in white walls.
I mean the studio was tiny, but to be honest with you, I did not even expect to have my own like music office. I thought I would have a small table somewhere and stuff, but I got to have a nice monitor. I had like a real mouse and a real keyboard and then my musical keyboard, and I had my microphone, and every time I wanted to record, I could shut the door. So for me, it was a studio at
set up basically. I'm just curious. This is like completely, I want to say off book or something, but you had your mic there because you did add vocal elements to the mm-hmm. recordings, right? I'm imagining that the echo and the noise was difficult to work around. How was the sound of engineering for that?
I love that you asked this question. So, on the ship, there was a constant hum from the engines. Yeah. And for the first few days, I wrote everything in B flat. And I did not understand why I wrote everything in B flat until one day I'm like, let me see what pitch that hum is. And it was a B flat.
Oh, you were being influenced.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, but wow.
Other than the hum, at least at the bottom of the ship, there was no other sound. And I brought this dynamic mic, so it didn't take up a lot of the hum. You can hear it. But I brought it more to just record like scratch vocals. I still have a lot to develop and finalize, and that would be on a real microphone.
More interesting projects that you've done in 2021 is your project with Fantastic Fest, where you were given the project of scoring a full film, but not just mm-hmm. any film, a 1925 silent film, The Lost World, which is, I can't, if you ask a real film junkie, that's like, it's an iconic one. It's one of the starting points to most, I'm going to say, adventure films.
Yeah.
And I'm going to, I hope I offend no one, but there is this mindset to, I want to say normal people, like the musicians are abnormal, but to normal people, that if you're a pop, in your case, mostly jazz, or let's say you're a general musician, that's the wrong word, but you're a general musician, you write a certain type of music, and where you're a composer, you write a certain type of music, and if you're one, you can't be the other, and vice versa. And even though some people put it in their bio as both, they're always known for one or the other. Which we know as musicians, it's not true, but okay, let's just go on with this trend. So I want to know, coming from a songwriter framework, what were some of the challenges that you had to take on when scoring a full film for a silent film, for example? What were some of the things that you didn't expect to be challenged by?
So I think... for me, it was actually that I got asked to do this commission to write for The Lost World through my label. So the Alamo Draft House, Fantastic Fest asked Ground Up Music to ask five artists to write music for the films. And being a singer, like you mentioned, and being a songwriter and using my voice with electronics, I felt a lot of pressure that that's what people were expecting of me. And when I was watching the film, and I was trying it out at first, to me it just didn't fit. And like you said, it's such a legendary film, and it's such a great film. And I also watched some of the previous scores that had been made for it, and the previous scores, to me, some of them were kind of distracting. They weren't really, like, if there was a slow, really emotional scene, the music was doom, 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 doom. And it's like,
quirky.
You know, that's not what's happening on the screen. So I decided actually to go an orchestral route because that's what I felt like the film needed. And because it's such a legendary film, it's a shame that it doesn't have its own score.
Yeah.
So I kind of decided to step aside as Sirintip, the artist with weird electronic vocals, and step into like a full film composer role. And there are some parts in the film where I do use my voice, but it's kind of blended in with the rest, and with electronics, it's hard to hear. Yeah. But I think the most challenging thing, because I'd never scored for film before, was it was 105 minutes. That's a lot of music.
A lot of music.
3 months to do this. And with no previous experience. So the first month I just needed to, like, how do you score for film? So I was on YouTube just learning. And also just technically in my software program, Logic, how do you line up the music with the video and make sure that the music doesn't move? Because if there's a gunshot or something and I'm hitting it perfectly, but I don't know how to lock the audio to the film, then it would not be perfect. So there is like technical challenges like that. And then I wrote the score in about 6 weeks. So I needed to write 5 minutes of music a day in order to finish on time. And
it
if
was
I
a
didn't
schedule.
Write, yes, it was, I've never needed to write so much music in such a short amount of time. And if I did not write 5 minutes of music a day, the next day would have needed to be 10 minutes and 15 minutes. And that's hard because it would take me maybe 5-6 hours to write 5 minutes or more.
So what you're saying is after these 3 months, you were exhausted.
I was exhausted. And that last month was actually just trying to make all of the virtual instruments because I did everything in the computer. There was budget to have a real orchestra. So I needed to go in and write in all the expression and dynamics and do everything by hand to make the virtual instruments sound as real as possible.
It's great. I must say, I listened through it and I watched the film as well. I tried to YouTube align them.
You can watch it on Amazon.
I should have known that.
Or Alamo,
I love it. It really gives a bigger life to the film. And I want to also just go back to them, because when we think, like you said, when we think of silent films, but especially with Lost World, but in general silent films, they always have some type of orchestral piece over it that's either just quirky or doesn't make sense, or it's just some Beethoven thing that someone put over it and pops your uncle, basically. And it doesn't fit the emotive, or doesn't fit the message of the film, let's put it that way. And generally, when we do think about film composing and the process behind it, we always hear that the composer had the opportunity to sit down with the producers and directors and go through every tiny facet of every tiny frame. What do we want to hear here? What is the message? What is the emotion, et cetera, et cetera? And that the composer composes, director says yes, no, 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 what. And that's how a soundtrack is composed. But you can't sit down with the director of this film, obviously. So you've already told us you had to go, you had a thought process. You didn't want to make it into a vocal thing. You wanted to make it orchestral, et cetera, et cetera. But what elements of the film stuck with you that allowed you to portray the visuals within the music, if I can put it that way? How did you bring the director's story into the music? Because the music that you wrote is so fitting for this film.
Thank you so much. That means a lot. Well, I think I was very influenced by John Williams, and also, like, I love movies.
I felt John Williams throughout that. Yeah, so hard.
And if you think about the old movies, like the early 2000 movies, they all have scores, and they're really letting the music be the third lead character. Because if you think about Star Wars or Jurassic Park, any of these big movies, they would not be the same movies without the fitting scores. And, you know, nowadays a lot of films, they just have songs that are being licensed. So it's like they make the film and then they're like, okay, let's put a Taylor Swift song here, or let's put a Billie Eilish song. And there's no marriage between what's happening on the screen and the music. So for me, I watched the film, I think, 3 or 4 times, and I drew out the lead characters. So I was like, okay, Ed Malone, how does he sound like as a melody?
Hola.
The Brontosaurus, what would it sound like as a melody? So I went in and gave each character its own melody, and then I had that as my, like, foundation material that I used over the entire score. And I would just use different arranging devices of, like, changing the key or changing the tempo, changing the time signature, putting in the different instruments.
Yeah. Even back to basics. Yeah. Like, all the way back to basics. That is interesting, because it's very, it's exactly as you put it. We see a lot in film today. And one of our previous guests, Dean, we had a long conversation about this, that it's basically cover songs or just the original songs within movies. Mm-hmm. It's very, you don't see, not epic, but you don't see epic soundtracks anymore. Soundtracks that are so part of the film that you can't separate from the film. Like you said, there's not a marriage between it. So I was so happy to, when I was listening to it, like, oh yes, love it. So congrats on that, man. Congrats.
But, thank you. It was so fun. So much work. So much work in this room right here.
I was just like, 3 months, she was dead.
I got my blue light glasses, though.
I think that's a good decision afterwards.
Yeah, a lot of screen time.
But I want to go on to a section that is our stalker section of this podcast. And I always say that should be a crime. It is probably in somewhere in the world. And someday someone's going to call me out on this. But I like to go on social medias of guests and then just check out, because I feel that you get the essence of the artist through the social media, or the behind the scene look to it. So I surfed, let me just use the stellar terminology. I surfed the Stellar Mageddon. I found some interesting posts on your Instagram page. And then just for all the astronauts listening, please head on over to our YouTube page or our Discord server community to have a look with us. So I am going to successfully share my screen.
Okay.
Hopefully. And then I'm going to show you some pictures I found. And then I just want to, like, know, give me some behind the scene context, if you will. Do you see that?
Oh.
I love the glasses. Love the glasses. What, where, how, and why?
So I think this was back in 2000. Based on the jacket, it's probably 14 or 15. So this is right before I moved to New York. It was right before I moved to New York. And I just needed some, like, because I was like, oh, I'm going to move to New York. So I need something to show people when they meet me and they don't know who I am. And I wanted to look the way I want people to perceive me.
Yeah.
So I did this photo shoot with a friend who is a great producer and pianist, Erik Jonasson. He's Swedish. And we went to the Swedish amusement park in Stockholm called Gröna Lund, where a lot of artists have performed. And we just did a photo shoot there. And I got some cotton candy.
And these,
like, vintage glasses and the sweater and the leggings are from a really cool Swedish designer called Love A Lot. And I loved all the prints that she made. And then the jacket, I remember where that's from.
A really cool photo, though.
Thank you.
I just, like, love the glasses. Oh, why does not one? Oh, there we go. Ah, there we go. But isn't it? Yeah, this is the next one. Let me just zoom in. This is definitely a big show. I think that is you over there.
Yes.
Bowing down. Where is this and what concert was this?
This was in Berlin. I believe the venue was called Ework.
Mm-hmm.
Unless Ework is in Cologne. I'm so sorry. Everything kind of like blends in my brain.
Blurs.
But this was in October of 2019. And I was asked to open up for Snarky Puppy.
Yeah.
So you can see Michael Lee there on bass and Mark Letourneur on guitar. And then Justin Stanton on keyboards. He's behind Michael Lee. He's a little hidden. Yeah. He's bowing too. It's just me and Justin bowing. And then
he is.
Yeah. And then we had Ross Peterson on drums. Ross Peterson was actually the original drummer of Snarky Puppy.
Ah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It seemed like a great show. It's quite packed in there. This is a space for anyone. That's really cool. I'm assuming this was for Lost World. No, that we've spoken about it. Yeah.
Exactly. So as a part of my research phase before I started writing, I went to the National History Museum to look at all the dinosaurs to really get a feel for how they would sound.
Oh, that's cool. Just a little in real life inspiration, right? I'm assuming this is you. I hope I don't have a picture of a random child on my computer, but this is you, right?
Yes, this is me. Yeah, and I'm dressed up as Pippi Longstocking in Swedish. Yeah. Pippi Longstrump. She was a big inspiration for me growing up. And that's probably also why I started to play jazz later on in life, because she does everything her way.
Oh, I was like, is there some jazz version of her that I don't know? I was really confused for a second.
No, just her essence of her character.
Just the sassiness. I love the sassiness. The wig is the wig. It's the wig for me.
For me too.
Love it. It's so cute. I love this picture. I don't know for what it is, but I love it. It's so. Yes. That's all.
Yeah.
It is. It's so classy. Tell me all about this.
Okay. So, obviously I learned to sing jazz in my teens. And then I continued to sing jazz, and that's why I moved to New York to sing jazz. And back in the day, I did a lot of traditional jazz competitions. Mm-hmm. And one of my first jazz bands, it was called the Thai Queen and the Kings of Swing.
The Thai Queen and the Kings of Swing.
Yes.
Nailed it.
Yes.
Oh, wow. That's a name. That is a name.
Yeah. And this band was the development of that. And it's called the Vipers Orchestra. So we would have five horns playing these, like, big band arrangements, but for five horns instead. And we would perform, and we would always dress up really nicely.
Fancy. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm starting to get back to this version of my jazz diva self. So now I'm performing quite often at the Amman, New York.
Mm-hmm.
They have a jazz club there in the basement and probably one of the best sounds in the city. So when I'm not doing electronic weird pop music, I'm singing jazz at the Amman.
This is such a... this picture has such a mood to it. I love it. I really do. It just, this is what I picture when I picture jazz musicians. I couldn't say it now for a second. It's classy. It gives me 1920 feels.
Yeah,
you know,
that's what we were going for. And this is actually my aunt's old apartment. So this was her dining room. And the top right corner, the little boy in the picture frame, that's my uncle. And then the guy to the left is his dad. And then the person in the middle was his grandfather.
You have a lot of influences from the jazz community that you've spoken about, from your time with Snarky Puppy, from your vintage clothing, from everything. But what most people do know about you, you do have a very, I'm going to say eccentric, you have a rich cultural background. You are Swedish Thai, born in Bangkok. So it's a hot pot of cultures and influences. And especially with the Scandi and the Thai, it seems to me it's two very opposite spectrums of the world or spectrums of culture. So what I would like to know from you is, how does your Thai side influence you, and how does your Scandinavian side influence you, and how are they alike? Mm-hmm. Because it's two very different ones, right?
Yeah. So I think, I guess I'll start with the similarities, that they're both very humble cultures. Both Thai people and Swedish people don't really take credit for the things that they do. And, you know, they're very kind and modest people. I would say that the Thai influences obviously comes through in my music with the Thai language, and also on Carbon with Thai tuning and Thai instruments. And my Swedish influences, I think I have to thank them for allowing myself to be fully exploring my creativity to the fullest extent. In Thailand, when I was studying there, it's a very different type of education system where it's very kind of like fact-based. There was not a lot of room for the students to think for themselves or to have any kind of essay questions or elaborate. It was very much like checking boxes.
Basically, yeah.
And I think culturally that's often the case too, that Thai people are, I don't want to say forced, but they're encouraged to work inside the box.
Yeah.
Versus in Sweden, it's all about think outside the box. Like, how far can you take this? And it's a very, very progressive culture. So I have the Swedish side to thank for my weirdness, everything non-typical that I do.
Thank the Swedes.
Yeah.
I've mentioned a few experiences and a few collaborations, and we've previously talked of other experiences that you've had in your career, but if you have to think back through your lifetime as a musician, what experience stands out to you uniquely?
Musical experience or any experience?
Any experience. Oh, wow.
Why do you make it so hard for me, Leandri? Give me some kind of guide. I mean, I can't. I've lived for like 3 decades now. I have a lot of experience.
They ask me the one that goes like, that was the one. This is the rapid fire all over again. I'm telling you.
I'm feeling the heat. Well, I guess maybe moving to New York and really making that leap for myself. Because before I moved to New York, when I was studying at the Royal College of Music in Stockholm, I was also working as a production coordinator at Fasching, which is the jazz club in Stockholm. And I met a lot of artists who came through, and a lot of them were Americans and lived in New York and, you know, had their career here. And I obviously love that, and I learned so much from being around them and hearing them perform every night. But there was one night where one of my big role models, who I'd been looking up to my entire, like since I was a teenager. And, she asked me if I wanted to become her manager. And when she asked that question, I think that was the moment I realized that I had focused too much, or I've been like worked too much as a production coordinator and being on the other side of the stage. And that if I wanted to have my own musical career, I needed to really make that a priority.
Yeah.
So that kind of like pushed me to take the leap to move to New York. And I've been very, very happy of daring to cut the ties of any kind of safety net and just moving to a new place, not knowing anyone, not knowing how anything is going to turn out. And as you heard in the beginning of this conversation of like, I'm dealing with moving and then I'm just like this mom competition and you know. So like since I moved to New York, I feel like my life has really moved in the direction that I want to take it.
Completely flipped around if it describes like that. I mean, it sounds like that New York was the starting point to everything for where you are now. The record label, the Snarky as well with your style. It seems it was the catalyst, if we can put it that way.
What a good to
thank you for joining me at the Stellar Sound podcast today. But before we go, I want to give you a chance to shout out any platforms or projects. But before I give you that opportunity, remember to go follow us in the Stellar Sound Discord community or head on over to Instagram for the latest Stellar updates. But Sarah Tip, the floor is yours. Any projects, platforms you'd like to shout out?
Well, I want to give a shout out to my team. So Nolan Bird, my co-writer and drummer and husband, and Nick Hard, my co-producer, and Geng Shikat, which is my keyboard player. He's also Thai, so he does all the Thai tuning on Moog synthesizers on this album. And Nichat Otong, which is the visual designer that we talked about. Michael League, who is the bass player and also my music artistic consultant for the album, Ground Up Music. Rope A Dope, who put out my album. And Lydia Liebman, who is my publicist, and the Asian American Arts Alliance, New York Foundation of the Arts, STIM, the Swedish Cultural Council. Yeah, I think that's it.
Amazing.
And couldn't have done it with them.
I mean, really. And they, you do feature a lot of them on your pages where they give us little behind-the-scenes looks into every facet of what they created with the album. Especially your collaborators, and I mean, the most amazing people, honestly. Their mindset, their work ethic, their chat, how they approach projects is just, it's next level. It's truly just a different way of thinking. But listeners and fellow astronauts out there, from me, Leandre Paulson, and my guest, Sarah Tippi, want to thank you for joining us here at the Stellar Sound podcast. But the countdown has begun, and it is time to blast off into the stratosphere. Remember to empower creative musicians everywhere, and we'll meet again at the next Stellar Meeting.